Roberto Azzacardvello. This is TabilePod.com coming to you from our studios high atop Tbilisi's charming Rustaveli Avenue. Today is Thursday, the 21st of February, 2013. On this date, in 1613, Mikhail I is elected unanimously as Tsar by a National Assembly, beginning the Romanov dynasty in Imperial Russia. 1804, the first self-propelling steam locomotive moves in Wales. 1848, Karl Marx and Fred Engels published the Communist Manifesto. 1921, Georgia's Constituent Assembly adopts the first constitution. 1925, The New Yorker publishes its first issue. 1948, NASCAR is incorporated. 1953, Evtime Takaishvili, historian, archaeologist, public benefactor, and all-around cool guy, died. In 1958, the peace symbol first appears before a nuclear disarmament demonstration. 1965, Malcolm X is murdered. 1972, Nixon lands in mainland China. 1994, Russian CIA double agent Aldrich Ames is arrested. Birthdays today are philosopher John Rawls, singer Nina Simone, director Sam Peckinpah, poet W.H. Auden, whack job Robert Mugabe, writer Irma Bombeck, and steaming smokestress Melanie Laurent. We are Cameron Christensen, Matthias Hooter, and me, Mark Mullen. Nothing we say can be connected with any of our past, present, or future employers. We have a special guest today that you have probably heard of, Professor Charles Fairbanks. Welcome. Thanks again to those for posting on the forum. This is from TabilePod.com's chief priest and lawgiver, Will Dunbar. And I quote, "When discussing Kopitavitashvili, it is always worth reminding ourselves that he is godfather to one of Misha's children, and Misha is godfather to one of his. Goes to show you just how the roots of much of what is going on stretch back to personal issues in the past. And yes, he was filmed trying to sell places on his party list for the 2006 local elections. This resulted in him being booted out of his own party, the Conservatives. Also, for bonus geek points, always important with Will, I don't think Bokeria was on the group of trust under Okhrosvili. The main people were Givi Targamadze and Nikusha Rudua, the head and deputy head of the Parliament's Defense and Security Committee at the time. Bokeria was deputy head of the Legal Issues Committee at the time, I think, which is correct.
Yeah, that he put. I think I also think that Bokeria was on the in the group of trust because it was a four parliamentarians and it was established in February 2004 according to Article 28 of the Rules of Procedure of Parliament. And yeah, I did some research. It was all members of the United National Movement, and they objected to having any member of the opposition included.
So sorry, Will. Sounds like Cameron's got you on that one. Unfortunately, I myself was not able to independently verify because our research intern was on strike since the new government.
I'll just call Geek.
Yeah, but all right. So Geek points to Cameron on that. Sorry, Will. We're going to block you on the forum. All right. Also on the forum, an excellent photo of the real individual responsible for painting the statue of Stalin pink. Check it out if you can. If you'd like to comment or ask a question, go to tabilepod.com or send an email to tabilepod@gmail.com. Like all responsible Georgian journalists, we never quote or attribute anything, unless we're allowed to, or you give your real name, or a really good fake name. My Georgian Journal and Kvitis Balitra column this week is about prisoners, police, and crime, and the complicated question of people that were thrown in jail under the previous government unfairly, but who are nevertheless criminals. Okay, on Tuesday, Rustavioti published a video from 2004 which shows the police arresting several people, including Buto Robachidze, who was shot and killed during the incident. Robachidze's death led to a large outcry and much criticism in 2004. The Ministry of Internal Affairs was accused of covering up the murder by putting weapons in the car Robachidze was driving to save the reputation of the new patrol police. In the Rustavioti video, you can clearly see weapons in the car. In 2012, the new government launched an investigation into former high-ranking officials from the Interior Ministry, accusing them of fabricating evidence and of intentionally killing Robachidze. Irakli Pirkalava, a former high-ranking policeman and one of the accused, gave the video to Roustavioti in order to prove his innocence. Robakhidze's relatives, along with representatives of political organizations and NGOs, gathered outside Roustavioti to protest the airing of the video footage without the family's consent. They claim the video was edited and is therefore not credible. Later, Gocha Mukbaniani, a former journalist for the Patroli program, also asserted that the original footage from Robakhidze's case didn't show any weapons in the car. He said, quote, "The video footage released yesterday shows weapons. However, the original video footage didn't include any." End quote. Mukbaniani says he doesn't know what happened to the original footage. Guram Donadze, former head of the press service of the Interior Ministry, said that the footage includes what was released in 2004. He said he didn't know that the rest of the footage existed. "I'm not a murderer, and today I have proved this," end quote. Donadze said, and added that he trusts Chief Prosecutor Archil Kbilashvili.
So it's important to note that there's an ongoing investigation, A. B, that they only managed to, like, block out Robakhidze's face or, like, fuzz it out during this video, and that I think there has already been a public statement that was made by a group of NGOs saying that this was a clear violation of judicial procedure.
Yeah. But also, I think so, again, it was like a number of TV channels aired that, and, you know, it was a perception that it was inappropriate to air that material. But Roustavi2, I mean, Roustavi2 was criticized mostly because I think they were the first, but to their credit, the same evening they invaded the head of the Charter of Journalism Ethics on the show to discuss, you know, like, ethics in reporting on this issue. Well, other channels also aired it, and they, you know, didn't add the kind of the discussion element to it. So kind of a lot of the attention was on Roustavi2, but basically everybody then aired it as well.
Chairman of Parliament Datu Subashvili released a statement on Facebook saying that an agreement over constitutional changes could not be reached between the ruling coalition and national movement. An agreement was nearly reached, but at the very last moment, UNM backed away because of issues pertaining to the format and content of the amnesty of public officials. MP Dato Bakradze replied that nobody is demanding immunity. However, the questioning of people connected to UNM should stop. According to Bakradze, the parliamentary majority offered to stop the prosecution of low-level officials, meaning those below the heads of departments. Bakradze says prosecuting low-level officials would be irrational anyway, since they are just technical staff. Misha denied that the UNM demanded political amnesty. He said in a statement, quote, "I would like to remind everyone that Putin publicly gave me a death sentence, and I was not scared. After that, I'm not afraid of this local petty blackmail, which is awkward and ridiculous." Yeah.
But, I mean, the UNM said, you know, or Misha said, we didn't want the amnesty, but then it's not clear why the negotiations failed, at least based on what Usupashvili released. And understand that the Georgian Dream said, yes, you can have basically an amnesty with some exceptions, but what we want is that the people have to come forward and admit that, yes, I was involved in something criminal, like abuse of power or corruption or other criminal acts. And that if they would admit that, then they would be barred from running for office for 5 years, which I think is fair. You know, like if somebody says, I did something, I abused my office, that it's kind of a mild consequence, I think, to bar him from holding public office for 5 years. Well, Misha said basically they wanted to impose a five-year ban on every official in the United National Movement to hold office, which I think is a very different thing. So he said the Georgian Dream demanded that we can't go back into power for 5 years, and that's why the negotiations collapsed. So.
According to Subashvili, they said that they're demanding unconditional and full amnesty for everyone besides the president, ministers, and members of the parliament for all offenses committed prior to October 1st, 2012, except for violent crimes, crimes against constitutional governance, and other similar grievous felonies. And that's what they apparently are refusing to agree to, because they don't want to give this amnesty to those people.
Yeah, I mean, it's a, you know, there are a lot of important details in there, not the least of which is whether they're talking about October 1st or November 1st.
Yeah, I also read November 1st.
Here, this is the statement from Usubashvili, but then I saw in the news also that it said November 1st.
Right, I mean, they each side wants a different date, you know. It's pretty complicated. I think, on the one hand, I mean, the statement by Usubashvili was quite clear. It was also clearly written in English, edited by a native speaker, which is not always the case. I don't know whether, you know, that certainly interfered with the negotiation. I don't know whether the negotiations can work now after he said that. I mean, first of all, whether or not it's true, I suspect probably it is, but who knows. It's understandable that it would then be denied by the national movement, but, you know, what happens now that it's sort of, you know, the cat's out of the bag, the national movement just sort of says, you know, no, we never talked about that, they're all lying. I mean, I have no special information about that, it's just that it certainly now it seems unlikely that they're going to be able to agree to much.
Well, it says that it was Misha who said that they didn't say that, it wasn't Bakradze, right? Bakradze is not the one who said that they weren't talking about that. I think they both came out and said that they disagree on the fact of amnesty.
Right.
And then Saakashvili said that he is insulted by even the use of the term amnesty in relation to the United National Movement and that it shouldn't be applied to UNM figures.
On Monday, the hardest working organization in the CAUC, Transparency International Georgia, organized a conference with public officials to discuss the government's first 100 days in office. TI Georgia, along with representatives of other NGOs, discussed the transfer of power, the adoption of the law on amnesty, the list of political prisoners, trials of former government officials, nepotism in public service hiring, situation in the media, and the recent violence at the National Library. Bidzina, or Bibliogeddon, as it was named. Bidzina, who attended the meeting, said he also had questions about the amnesty law, but he's sure that the majority of those released were serving time because of mistakes that the justice system had made. TI Georgia highlighted the demonstrations outside local government offices and the many officials who were replaced in the region. BI suggested that the tension between local government and the population is because local governments were not independent for a long time. He added, "Now it's important to avoid confrontation and to prepare a draft of reforms for local government, a draft. This is already finished and will soon be ready for a public hearing." All was calm for over 2 hours, with largely NGOs speaking and Otsneba brass listening and taking notes. Then former Deputy Justice Minister Georgi Vashadze gave a loud, aggressive tirade, annoying the heck out of everybody. Sadly, Justice Minister Teotsu Lukiani took the bait and accused him of giving unlawful orders to his employees related to passports. Vashadze, also at the conference, responded and said to Lukiani, by denying his diplomatic passport was breaking the law. There was lots of yelling after that. After a while, it went back to normal. But at least for me, I was really... it was interesting to see the dynamic, first of all, of Otsneba listening quite carefully to what all the NGOs were saying. And I mean, you know, the NGOs were putting up some pretty good points, but I wouldn't say it was really very sort of cohesive. It was just different NGOs talking about different stuff. And then, you know, Vashadze and the other MPs, national movement MPs present, were really not, I mean, they didn't really have much of a role there, frankly. It was between NGOs and the government, and they really sort of turned it into a debate, which nobody really wanted.
But that's also important to note, though, that, you know, maybe civil society doesn't always speak with one voice. So it's great that there's, you know, a plethora of, you know, views in the room, and that people are being listened to, and that there's.
I mean, I think for the most part, the NGOs agreed. I mean, it was largely Gaila, ISFED, and TI.
Some media people.
They listed
a lot of details. They didn't really, you know, prioritize them. I think the more important takeaway was how Otsneba had a lot of very senior people there who listened for a couple of hours. That doesn't happen too often. And let's hope that it continues that way. But the other one was that, I mean, I thought, you know, especially with Bibliogeddon, you know, the question was, whose fault was it? Did Ugulava incite the whole mess and they, you know, went in the wrong door and were just being a bunch of aggressive jerks? Or was it that, you know, that the police didn't do anything and that they let these, you know, angry released prisoners and whoever else and, you know, parents of Orthodox parents and whatever else come in and bust heads of a bunch of senior officials? Like, who caused it? All I can say is in this particular case that I really felt that the national movement was being much more aggressive.
Well, or it could be like California traffic law, which assigns percentage of fault.
percentage of fault, right. Okay, so I've named my 51%. There was a GIF file of the U.S. ambassador throwing down his translation earphones in the middle of Vashadze's speech. Certainly the speech was deeply annoying, but it was also really loud, and the ambassador was sitting next to Vashadze, and the translator was sort of speaking up, not into the microphone. So I think that had more to do with the fact that you just couldn't really hear the translation than him being annoyed with Vashadze's speech, which is what the Facebook chatter said.
It strikes me that, I mean, one should step back just a step and say that it seems characteristic of the national movement that it mounts what really are the unique Soviet category provocations, that is, efforts to force someone and to do something that puts them in a false position or makes them do something injurious to their own interests. And that this is the primary strategy now of the national movement, rather than appealing to people about things that they care about. Like in Kakheti, there are electrical outages now almost every day, and no one knows why. And this is never mentioned by the national movement, while the story of their martyrdom and their passports and this and that is endlessly rehearsed. It's strange for a political party.
Yeah, I would absolutely agree with that. And you know, I would say that they're very effectively manipulating the quick-temperedness of some of the members of the Otsneba team. You know, particularly in this case, Tsoulikiani. You know, that if Otsneba could keep their cool and focus on whatever it is their message is, and I'm not sure what their message or platform is, and they need to do some thinking about that, but, you know, then frankly, the national movement is likely to sort of be a little bit gone from the news, but, you know, by you know, this event, nobody talked about any of the policies that was discussed on the news. What they did was talk, you know, was cover the yelling match. Those were the right. You know, the Facebook snippets that went around, and that's what was covered on the news.
Also a reflection of the media.
Indeed, a reflection of the media. I mean, which, you know, okay, it's like that all over the world, but right. And it's
but
hard
here,
to...
here, in this case, it's kind of controlled by the parties,
right.
Directly or indirectly, at least the major TV stations.
Yeah, there's no you know, there's no real sort of policy wonky NPR type thing here. On February 13th, Tsoulikiani summed up her first 100 days in office in a press conference with diplomats and journalists. She commented on the refusal of the minority MPs to go to law enforcement structures for testimonies and said that these people will be visited at their offices in parliament for interrogation. Tsoulikiani also said that the most painful aspect of the ministry is the National Bureau of Enforcement. Quote, it became a national tragedy that people were forced to move out of their houses, end quote. The Justice Ministry is going to take two steps in this direction, raise public awareness, and have stricter legal regulations for usurers, or mevachshebi, meaning, you know, moneylenders. On Tuesday, BI presented Gheorghe Gakharia, that's not Gheorghe Gvakharia, but Gheorghe Gakharia, the new business ombudsman, at a meeting with business leaders, the economy minister, the minister for regional development, and agriculture minister. He worked as Lufthansa's director general in Eastern Europe. After BI's introduction, the meeting continued behind closed doors. Afterwards, the head of the supervisory board of Bank Republic, Lasha Papuashvili, said that the business situation in Georgia has changed and now there is no more fear. Lasha certainly seemed to done pretty well under the national movement. I'm not sure why he was so fearful, but anyway. Free health care will be introduced in the coming weeks. Health Minister Dato Sergeko said that starting from the end of February, an additional 2.2 million people will be able to use universal state insurance. Starting April 1st, social allowances for people with disabilities will be increased from 100 to 125 lari per month.
And this was basically, these are like two of the very big campaign platforms that they had, is, you know, healthcare for everybody and more social protection of vulnerable people. But this was announced today, and I'm not sure if they can really, you know, implement that just in a couple of weeks, as they announced. It's going to be really challenging. They said they're going to insure everybody who doesn't qualify for private insurance in Georgia. And that is certainly a problem that the insurance sector is, you know, like in many countries where it's not very well regulated, is very selective in whom they accept and under what terms and conditions. But it might also, that the government has to be careful that they don't, that people don't drop out of private insurances. And also another challenge is that the hospitals are almost all owned by the private insurance companies. And so there needs to be proper oversight that they don't hike up prices that they charge to the government. So, I mean, it was like the government sold it as a fairly easy and logical step. But actually, I think it involves a lot of very technical aspects that I'm not sure. Maybe they have addressed all these in the background, but
yeah, it's a pretty thorny question. I mean, there's also the question, being a business owner myself, is that at times the government doesn't pay its bills very quickly, which can amount to cash flow issues for hospitals. And if the government's supposed to reimburse, privately held hospitals that it is in essence in competition with, that would be a method by which pressure could be put on those hospitals, just simply not paying whatever reimbursements are required to be paid.
I also wonder how frequently they do this kind of reassessment of who receives social allowances. I mean, I just recently met a woman who said that she's no longer receiving her social allowance for being disabled, She doesn't understand why. And
it's a very complex system. I understand it's about 500,000 households that that qualify for social welfare in Georgia. But it's a point system. And for example, if you have a satellite dish or a new fridge, you get a lot of points and you're out of the qualification scheme.
Yeah, that's for poverty though. I mean, as opposed to disability.
Oh, sorry, disability might be another issue. Yeah.
On February 16th, BI was elected as honorary chairman of the Georgian Dream Democratic Georgia Coalition. The decision was made unanimously by all 1,680 delegates at the Georgian Dream Convention.
That's always a sign of a very democratic movement.
On the other hand, I mean,
yes.
Let's say, 101%. No, I want Koba Davidashvili.
There must be one disenfranchised person in that movement. I didn't get the ministry I wanted. I'm going to show him.
BI promised there will be unprecedented economic growth in Georgia in 1, 2, or 3 years. We're not sure which. He said that Misha told him that Ugalava and Matabashvili were heroes and they would go to prison with great pleasure. BI said, quote, "It seems it is his plan. It is his plan. They want many members of the UNM to be punished by law in order to be able to tell the U.S. and Europe that there is political persecution in Georgia. It is their ideology," end quote. By the way, his 57th birthday was this past Monday. His press service said, quote, "He does not like to celebrate his birthday," end quote. So now we know. UNM Secretary General Vano Matabashvili held a special briefing and invited Georgia's patriots to Rustavelli Avenue. That's his quote, not mine, Georgia's patriots, to Rustavelli Avenue on the 19th of April at 4 p.m. in front of the old parliament building. Matabashvili said, quote, "I want to invite all Georgia's patriots to show the current government that we are not indifferent to our children's future. Georgia must not return to the past with no democracy and no freedom. We want our children to have a guaranteed future. Georgia must not be enslaved," end quote.
And I understand that the theme that people should rally for is a Western foreign policy,
right,
rather than a Russian one, which I'm not sure is the most sexy theme for a mass protest. Is like the nuances of our foreign policy should be more firmly established than they are currently. So.
Well, it's interesting because we talked about last week how the Georgian, how currently Georgia has managed to actually get some items at least under review on the Russian market. They're at least looking economically, if not politically, north as well as west.
Right.
And I don't think, I mean,
but
this is the whole thing.
Selling giving Bortomi to the Russians.
But this is the whole idea of trying to create this kind of mutually exclusive, international policy. And I'm not sure that people are going to take the bait. And especially this Georgian Patriot thing, like that's just annoying. And the Georgian Patriots, regardless of party affiliation, please come.
Georgian Patriots will rally for a pro-American stance. Okay. Lawrence Lessig, director of the Constitutional Center at Harvard University, visited Georgia this past week to make assessments regarding changes to the constitutional model. According to Lessig, the parliamentary model is the most stable, and its cultivation will be important for Georgia. He said early constitutional changes will be a progressive step. As to the balance between the prime minister and president, Lessig said that the existence of a political balance was necessary. In addition, he does not think Misha will hamper changing of the constitutional model. The trip was paid for by USAID via Chemonix, and as usual, they didn't let anybody know, which is too bad when a big shot like this shows up.
I actually wanted to ask Dr. Fairbanks about this. I was very interested in kind of this dual electoral system for a single governing body, so that Parliament has both the majoritarian seats as well as the party list system, when in reality those two types of parliamentarians actually are supposed to be covering all of Georgia and don't represent necessarily constituencies. Do you have any commentary on that? I mean, I've always wondered about it because I've heard negative feedback from other people within the Council of Europe saying that it's kind of a bizarre system to have two electoral processes.
Well, the whole issue of electoral systems, proportional or single-member districts or mixed, is an intensely controversial one in political science and political practice. And no system is perfect. Theoretically, I think there's a good case for the Georgian system, because Georgia is a country with very different and regions with historical identities, like Hevsereti or Svaneti, which are represented, at least in the case of Svaneti, by single majoritarian representatives, have a historic identity and are very cut off. And the kind of situation that has been created in the United States by Supreme Court decisions, where every other Hawaiian island is attached to Oahu congressional districts, is a weird situation in a way. But the way it's worked out in practice really encourages dictatorship. Because the majoritarians, as we have seen since the election, tend to be opportunists who will just cut a deal with anyone who has political power. And from the standpoint of the way it works practically in Georgia, I think it would be better to have all proportional.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a complex issue.
Yeah, there's a lot of complexity around this, but one thing that could happen would be using the Bundestag system of having majoritarians affiliated with a national party, and having them count towards the overall total of the seats, because you could have a situation where this is a system that helped the PRI stay in power in Mexico for many years, of where you can have a because the majoritarian, you can win a minority of the votes, but the majoritarians can take you over the threshold to controlling the parliament. So if you should have it so that if 40% of the people vote for a particular party, you just carry over those majoritarians. The other thing that you could do is say, okay, Svaneti, since there are not so many people there, get one MP, but Cajeti gets 6 and Imanetti gets 8 and Tbilisi gets 23.
So looking at equality of the vote.
Yeah, so that it's one person, one vote, but you have multi-member constituencies, but so that they're, because if it was straight proportional you know, in reality, you'd end up having almost all city-based candidates, and you wouldn't have too many people in the mountains. And you could say Swanetti, and perhaps even, you know, Pshavi or Chebsudeti or any of the other mountainous, you know, traditional areas could get an MP.
And then there's the other issue, of course, that there's no runoff for majoritarian seats if one candidate has more than 30% in the first round. So there's also...
Yeah, which is a really terrible system. It really should
just
be.
Just file enough candidates.
Even better, I mean, it makes it much more difficult to count, but to have a preferential voting system. So and it really is difficult to count, but it's much fairer so that you can rank all your candidates. And that's a pretty effective mathematical way to create consensus candidates rather than, you know, it wasn't until 2008, as an American, that I ever voted for a president. I was always voting to keep a president out, you know, and that's the way it works when you only have one single vote.
And when you're from Texas.
And when you're from Texas.
As a Democrat.
And a Democrat, exactly. The ginormous Indian company Tata Group plans to invest hundreds of millions of dollars in Georgia, allegedly, supposedly, hopefully, especially in energy, tourism, agriculture and the recycling industry, as well as IT technologies. Managers of Tata Group decided to visit Georgia after meeting Bidzina's entourage at Davos.
I mean, like Tata, at least I'm not, you know, a big expert in that, but what they're known for is two things. One is cars and the other is steel, I think. I didn't know that they're in agriculture and tourism and energy. That is all new to me. Maybe they are.
They're big enough to be in whatever they want.
Yes. But I mean, this is also a tradition in Georgia that there's always, you know, the big foreign investors are coming, just wait a few more months, but they will bring the billions and you will see.
Right.
And that often never shows up, so you have to be careful with that.
The other thing I've heard about Georgia, though, is that it's a good test case because it's so small, you can actually, you know, kind of do a little pilot project here, basically, and test something out rather than try and go for scale in a different location
first. For consumer goods and stuff like that, services.
Yeah, makes sense. I mean, especially for a giant company like that. I would guess, from what I've heard, a lot of it's hydro. I mean, the real interest is hydro. Minister of Foreign Affairs Maya Panjikidze said in a public statement that BI and the Turkish Prime Minister Tayyip Erdogan reached an agreement to build a mosque in Batumi. Panjikidze said, quote, "They agreed that Georgian specialists will take part in the Oshki and Ishkani restoration, and a location will be allocated in Batumi where a prayer room will be built for Muslims. It's for Georgian Muslims in the first place, since they must be able to pray," end quote.
There's also a difference between a prayer room and a mosque.
That's true.
So
I think she was just sort of saying the prayer room, you know, sort of you get the idea of like a little behind the broom closet, you know, that kind of like, you know, some little place for them to do their little
Muslim
thing.
The Munich airport.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. The OSCE's ODIHR, based in Warsaw, have begun monitoring cases of former senior Georgian officials. The case against Bachua Khalaya was the first to be monitored. It has been postponed until February 28th.
He's still sitting in pretrial detention, yes?
Yes, as far as I know. Mm. Chief Prosecutor Archil Kvilashvili said over 700 prisoners died in prison from 2005 to 2012. Quote, "We are investigating the real causes of their deaths because there is information that many of them were killed," Kvilashvili, end quote. Kvilashvili said in a statement, "The result of this investigation will be made public in March." A Moscow court sentenced MP Givi Targamadze to imprisonment in absentia. Targamadze was found guilty of organizing mass disorder in Russia in coordination with the leftist leader Sergei Udaltsov and Leonid Reznikov.
Yeah.
Or something. These Russian names, I can't deal with them. So Givi was trying to overthrow the government of Russia, you know? I mean, probably he was, you know? I mean, knowing him. With his $600.
It just takes one hole in the dike.
Exactly. The photo reporters Nadia Gednidze, Georgi Abdaladze, Irakli Gednezidze, and Zura Kurtsikidze call on Chief Prosecutor Kvilashvili to reinvestigate their case. They said, quote, We were accused of espionage by the previous government without any grounds. We did not have any chance to prove our innocence. End quote.
So can I clarify? I thought it was that they wanted it to be declassified, because I thought that their case is, the information has been classified.
That could be. That makes sense. I mean, if the whole thing was classified. If all of the different ridiculous trials of the National Movement, this was the most egregious, preposterous, obviously malarkey is the best word I can come up with. I mean, it was really, really ridiculous. You know, so let's hope that that was.
After several weeks in prison last year, they pleaded guilty of espionage for Russia, or were coerced probably into signing these statements, and then they were released, which is a joke by itself, because if somebody admits he's spying for your enemy, usually they're not allowed to walk free.
Right, exactly.
But there was, rightly so, lots of pressure from within the country and from outside the country to get these people free.
Boris Ivanov, former head of the criminal police of Tbilisi, demands an investigation into charges against him in a 2006 case. He maintains his innocence. His lawyer said, quote, "The case has been in court since 2007, and the investigation has not questioned a single witness. Ivanov currently resides in Moscow, and the charges were that they found drugs on him," as is so often the case. On Saturday, Tbilisi Mayor Guy Yugolava was questioned as a witness regarding the National Library incident. Interior Minister requested the interrogation. Yugolava cooperated.
Do you think Yugolava is going to go to the protest that Merabishvili is organizing?
I don't know. It's like he would sort of, somebody ought to tape his arms around his waist or something. I'm guessing he will. We'll see. About the Okhrashvili case that we said last week we'd comment on, I spoke with a person who was actually in the court monitoring the whole thing. And her impression was that the prosecutors really just were not doing anything. That whether or not the case was legitimate, I mean, the case was brought under the old government and had to do with, I can't even remember what
abuse of power.
But that the prosecutors were going through the motions so that the case could be dismissed. So it'll be interesting to see if anything else comes up regarding Okhrashvili and how that relates to whatever discussions he may have had with the government about how much prosecution would happen if he comes back. Because certainly he knows where a lot of the bodies are buried of the National Movement. Nikolos Khachirashvili, chairman of the UNM faction of Tbilisi City Assembly, left the party. He didn't say why, though he didn't deny that he has differences with former party members. He remains in the assembly as an independent member. Guram Misibashvili left the UNM faction in parliament and became an independent MP.
These people are all just following their conscience.
Yeah, they're just following. I mean, I can pretend no more, you know?
I have lied so long. I just want to be on the other side.
I just want to be free. On Monday, Armenia had its presidential election, and the Nagorno-Karabakh war veteran won with 59% victory, allegedly, over the nearest contender,
the incumbent Serge
Sarkisian, over Rafi and five other candidates. Rafi from Fresno and five other candidates. That's what I heard. The Armenian social media landscape had numerous reports of electoral fraud, including ballot stuffing, vote buying, bribery, disappearing ink, and violence against journalists. OSCE Odihr said everything looked just swell.
For Armenian standards, maybe.
I wish I could.
They said it's better than what has been in the past, which is exactly what the Armenian government promised.
A step forward. We promise it'll be, you know, better.
But I think they had the two strongest candidates drop out of the race beforehand.
Yeah, or they boycotted. I mean, the major parties, I think, boycotted the race.
Newspaper Khwela Siakhle reported that Georgian land is being advertised for sale to Punjabis on YouTube. The Indian company Crown Immigration, founded 3 years ago, offers consultations for those who wish to buy land. In the video, the Indian director of the company says that the land in Georgia is cheap and there are lots of cheap workers.
And I've seen a couple of articles in the English language Indian media where people talk about how they invested in Georgia and building farms in Kakheti and so on, and how, you know, how much better the soil is than in India and how much cheaper it is. And
yeah.
I mean, if
why not? Punjabis are good farmers.
Yeah, I mean, it's a double-edged sword, you know, like, right. you don't want foreigners to buy up all the land and like, displace right. the small farmers there, but on the other hand, if they buy land that is just not used and nobody has the capital to take put it to use. Then
The impression I have of the biggest problem there, having, you know, the time I've spent in Georgian villages, is that there's not a lot of people living in those villages. So let's say you got a village with 30% of the, you know, population is actually there. 70% is gone somewhere in Tbilisi or, you know,
especially
Moscow or Athens.
Especially
the young people. And so, you know, somebody's got title to this land in one way or another. And meanwhile, their neighbors have gotten used to over the last 5, 10, or 15 years grazing on it or planting it or, you know, whatever else. And then somebody comes in and buys it, often from somebody who doesn't really live anywhere near there. And especially if that person is Punjabi and doesn't speak Georgian or is like, you know, an Iranian that has bought up many thousands of hectares, right. It can get a little bit complicated, even if the title is quite quite clear.
Yeah.
And it takes a lot of support from the government to, you know, help out with the complexities
yeah.
that arise.
And, well, and you have, sorry.
I thought it was also illegal for foreigners to purchase agricultural land.
I think that was overruled like a year ago by the Constitutional Court. But one other thing is, like, the government in the past year built all these service centers where you have tractors and you could rent, like, all this, like, heavy machinery. And whenever I drive by them, there's nobody there and all the equipment is clean and nice and standing there. And I think the problem is, you know, I think the idea was that people could rent a tractor for a day and then, you know, do the job and bring it back, and that would be that they have enough money to do that. But I think most of the small farmers can't rent out the equipment that the government
well and there's also there's attempts to sort of figure out a way to share things. Nobody wants to use the word collectivize because there's a baggage with that, but, you know, anyway. No. Minister Dato has got a big job ahead of him. Georgian Municipal Development Fund reported that three infrastructure projects initiated in 2012 by UNM will not be implemented due to their large scale and ridiculousness. No, not ridiculousness. I just added that. The three are the so-called Hanging Bridge in Tbilisi, which would have connected Marshall, Gelovani, and Samtredia streets, a bridge connecting Mscheta with the Tbilisi-Leselidze highway, and a one-time supply of golden sand to Batumi's two-kilometer-long coastline.
It's not gold. It's just nice sand.
It's just
not
sand.
Golden
it's
sand.
Just sand. Yeah, I don't know where the sand is.
Because it's rocks otherwise.
Yeah, because otherwise it's rocks, which is fine. I love the rocks. You know, I think the rocks are nice. Great for drainage. Finance Minister Nodar Khaduri said that the mandatory labeling of soft drinks will not be enacted by March, as the former finance minister said it would be. Consultations on the issue are still underway. And by the way, recently established Soft Drinks Producers Association has asked the minister to cancel the labeling.
I love the labels on some of the Georgian soft drinks, which say 100%.
Yeah, we have purchased something that says literally only 100%. And doesn't say 100% natural, 100% verified, just 100%.
The Ministry of Education presented a new guidebook for teachers dealing with pupils with special needs. It focuses on integrating special needs students, sports classes, and learning strategies. There's a new Facebook group called Black Gang of Patriarchy, published photos of the patriarch's famous secretary, Shirena Tetruashvili, otherwise known as Shirena, eye shopping trip in Paris.
Yeah, it's been a...
Shirena the First, sorry.
Shirena
the First.
Shirena the First. Yes, supposedly the aim of the Paris trip was to meet with Georgians living in Paris, meet with UNESCO representatives, and visit the Laville Georgian Cemetery. But in reality, the group claims the patriarch Shirena and other visited luxury hotels, restaurants, and boutiques. From what I've heard from embassy staff about the visits of patriarch people to the rest of the world, they've got a lot of cash, like a whole lot of cash, and they blow it on those foreign trips.
But didn't Bizina even fly like a whole plane of priests to, like, I don't know,
yeah,
Europe in the campaign
like
period?
400 of them or something.
Yeah.
Hmm. Fly Georgia will start Tbilisi-Kiev flights beginning March 3rd. The flights will go four times a week, Monday, Tuesday, Thursday, and Sunday. A one-way ticket will cost €102. the excellently named Wizz Air announced it will double its capacity in Georgia by adding three new international routes from Kutaisi Airport. Two new Ukrainian routes to Donetsk and Kharkiv will start on April 23rd and July 1st, respectively. Wizz Air also unveiled the new Warsaw-Kutaisi service starting on May 15th. Tickets are already on sale starting at €28. For bookings, go to wizzair.com. Parliamentary news for this week. Parliament's plenary meeting approved new ambassadors to nine countries, including Eka Siddadze to France, Kakhayimnadze to the UN, Lado Chanturia, former justice minister and head of the Supreme Court under Shevardnadze, to Germany, who, by the way, has been in Germany for, I think, teaching in Tübingen or something, for a long time. He wrote the original Georgian civil code and most of the laws. David Aptsiaoudi to China, Mikhailu Kleba to Ukraine, and, as mentioned, Archil Gegashidze to the U.S. Candidates for vacant position in the Central Elections Commission were introduced but not approved because Georgian Dream decided not to participate in the voting until the scheduled electoral reforms are implemented. The Committee on Procedural Issues and Rules discussed MP Bidzina Gujabidze's suggested changes to the dressed code, which would allow MPs to wear Georgian traditional garments or chochas.
And bring knives. That's, I think, a very... it might be a bit concerning for parliamentary debates if MPs can, you know, throw a knife in the direction of the other political group whenever they're outraged.
Yeah, exactly. That's just what we need.
But it allows them, not requires them.
Yeah. Great. So the aggressive jerks can wear chokers and bring hanjals, and like the nice people...
At least on TV you can kind of separate.
Right. This week's GeoCapital number is 6.7, which is the official percentage of Georgians with hepatitis C. Just as a reference, in the U.S. the rate is 2.5%. In Europe the number is closer to 1%. Because of the high cost of treatment, only 1 in 10 infected Georgians receive any treatment at all. Even Georgian Health Minister Dato Sagarenko has acknowledged that the state doesn't have enough money to cover treatment costs for such a large portion of the population. And now for our special guest, Professor Charles Fairbanks, full professor of Soviet studies at Ilya Uni and senior fellow at Washington, D.C.'s Hudson Institute, a founder with Gia Nodia of the American Initiative for Liberal Education, and well-known man about the Caucasus, formerly of SAIS and Yale, and Deputy Assistant Secretary of State. Has written a lot about politics and what's going on now. Has lived here for several years. Before we started, I was reading a recent piece called New Chance for Democracy. Sorry, New Chance for Georgian Democracy. And you said something interesting. We're going to discuss it. You said, quote, "There is too much social science and not enough history in Georgian education."
Well, the West, and above all the United States, loves the social sciences, which tend to present political actors or citizens with a set of abstractions. And it's really from history that you learn the real consequences of political actions. I think if I had been alive in 1917, I would have been very attracted, as most young educated Russians were, to the idea of socialist revolution, only by looking at what happened after the equally promising French Revolution would one get any kind of sense of the complexities that might unfold. So the study of history would be really, really useful for a country like Georgia.
I feel like there's sort of there's a lot of Georgian history that people don't want to look at very carefully. I mean, I remember growing up in Dallas, Texas, that, you know, the Civil War was about states' rights. Nobody really talked about states' rights to do what. That history stopped right after Great Society, conveniently right before the Vietnam War, because the teachers couldn't agree on what to say about it. I think a lot, you know, I don't know what, how much consensus is there in Georgia about Georgia being a multi-ethnic civic nation with, you know, people of different faiths and different national backgrounds about what Georgia's history is?
Well, there's no consensus about it, I think, and there is a tendency to think that the real Georgia or Georgian tradition is what was believed in the Soviet Union minus what was obviously communist. So if you subtract atheism and the progressive significance of Georgia's annexation to Russia and all that nonsense, you get kind of authentic Georgia. And that's a very simple-minded view, because actually what Georgians thought about themselves, their history, and their culture during the Soviet Union was a very complex, even dialectical process of adaptation. There were nationalist reactions, adaptations to what one could say or publicly believe about Georgian history, and complicated reactions of those beliefs against each other. I think it takes a real specialist to really know what Georgia was before 1921.
You said in this A New Chance for Georgian Democracy, which was in the Journal of Democracy, quote, "In a longer historical perspective, Georgia needs to free itself from successive punishments of punishers," end quote. What do you mean by that?
Well, that the national movement was characteristically very punitive in its approach to the past. If one just listened to President Saakashvili talking about President Shevardnadze, in both an unhistorical and an ungenerous way, and unfortunately, because the national movement did do a lot of injustices, there's now a tendency for that pattern to repeat and to have a new series of punishments for the punishments that were done by the national movement. And I think there needs to be, while some of that is necessary, there were really frightful things done, that shouldn't be at the center of political life much longer. And there needs to be a policy decision, which is now under discussion, about where to draw a line.
This may be a related question, but I'll finish up with two questions. Operationally, if you were giving advice to the national movement, you know, what would you recommend that they do or stop doing, you know, right now?
Well, first is to stop trying to appeal to voters in the United States and Western Europe, because they will not vote in the next Georgian presidential election. And that has been the dominant strategy of the national movement, is to appeal for foreign support. And second, stop emphasizing as the biggest issue the suffering of leaders of the national movement. Mm-hmm. Though some of it's real, I suspect they have some things to really complain about. But nevertheless, in a democratic system, a party can only win by satisfying the needs of voters and not by complaining about the sufferings of its own leaders. My party could not have crawled back to any kind of viable position in American politics by talking endlessly about the sufferings of Richard Nixon, for example, that you had to start giving potentially Republican constituencies things they wanted, and the national movement is not yet doing that.
And what about on the other side for Otsneba and Georgian Dream? If you could give them some operational advice right now, what would it be?
Well, I think the great danger is the same danger that destroyed the national movement over the course of 9 years, that the party will turn into a kind of pale shadow of the state rather than a political party that wins by appeals to voters on political issues. And to avoid that, they need to very rigorously protect themselves against returning to the overuse of administrative resources in elections. To emphasize party organization, which is difficult because there are not many hardcore Otsnebists, and they have trouble staffing a government, but they really need to have a party organization that can go out there and campaign for votes, rather than relying on the Gumgabellis and the police and so forth. That's the pattern that eroded the support of the national movement.
Can I drop in maybe one question, maybe a quick one? Is I think what we see is the dilemma between accountability of those people in the previous government who were involved in very serious allegedly crimes and misdemeanors, and the other is how can we kind of reconcile society and avoid a continuing polarization. And what is your thought on that? I mean, how can we strike the balance between political pragmatism and justice?
Well, I think there are limits to how much justice can determine the whole shape of politics. And Plato's Republic is a kind of comic sketch of what would happen if the desire for justice determines the whole of politics, which has lots of ludicrous consequences if you read the book. I think for someone like Saakashvili, who I suspect has terrible things on his conscience, but nevertheless, for him, the greatest punishment would be not winding up in jail, but rather a bad place in the history of Georgia. And I think Georgian citizens who were victimized by him or leaders of Georgian Dream trying to determine their own conduct toward figures like Saakashvili and Marabishvili might bear that principle in mind. It is a very difficult issue. Most countries that had governments that did serious human rights violations and then a change of regime, part of the change of regime has normally been some kind of agreement to limit the accountability of the top leaders in the old government. And that can be a very useful thing. On the other hand, if you look at most of those cases like Pinochet, in countries that become democracies, those agreements usually don't hold up indefinitely. So that in practice, one has a certain reconciliation of the desire for political harmony and the desire for justice, but only over time.
Professor Charles Fairbanks, that was really, really interesting. I'm glad we had you on the show. Thanks for coming. Some announcements. This week's English language movies at the Rustavelli Theater across from Parliament are tomorrow, Friday night at 7:15, in English, Django Unchained for 10 lari and 50 tetri. Kolga movie tomorrow at 8 p.m. is Holy Motors, which looks wacky and interesting, and in French, or maybe German, at Dom Kino across from Rustavelli Metro and the McDonald's for 7 lari. Also, we don't often do it, like, for example, ever, but we want to thank Mitch and Taco for putting this whole thing together. That's it for this week. My Twitter address is at TXTBUK. That's Tango X-Ray Tango Bravo Uniform Kilo. Our email is tbilpod@gmail.com, or post to our forum on our website at www.tbilpod.com. And we'll end with, from 1951, John Henry by Big Bill Brunzi.
John Henry said to his shaker, "Now, man, why don't you sing? I'm shaking 12 pounds from my hip on down. Can't you hear that cold steel? Why don't you hear that cold steel ring? Why don't you hear that cold steel? Why don't you hear that cold steel ring?" Yes, he went down the track, but he never came back, 'cause he laid down his hammer and he, yes, he laid down his hammer and he died. Why he laid down his hammer and he, yes, he laid down his hammer and he died. John Henry hammered in the mountain was so high, the last word that I heard that poor boy say, "Give me a cool drink of water before I, give me a cool drink of water before I die, give me a cool drink of water before I, give me a cool drink of water before I die." John Henry had a little woman, and the dress that she wore was red, and the last word that I heard that little girl said, she said, "I'm going while John Henry build it. Yes, I'm going while John Henry build it. I'm going while John Henry build. Yes, I'm going while John Henry build it." John Henry was a little baby bird, and he held him in the palm of the hand, and the last thing that I know that poor boy said, "I'm gonna be a steel driving man. I'm gonna be a little steel driving man. I'm
I'm gonna be a steel driving man.